Hello and welcome to the Lutheran Answers podcast. Today I am joined by the wonderful Mr. Don Stein. We get to talk about Don's experiences on vicarage, Lutheran theology, on various subjects, and what it's like to train to become a pastor in confessional Lutheranism. I hope you enjoy this interview. Don is a wonderful friend of mine, a very dear friend of mine, and I very much enjoyed the opportunity to speak with him. And I hope it's a blessing to you as well. So with that, let's go ahead and hit that bump music. Thank you so much for hopping on with me to do this interview.
It's a joy. Thanks, Remy, for having me.
Thank you for all of the sermons that, whether you know it or not, you wrote them for me.
No. Spirit does the writing. You did the work, and I just gave a couple bits of input.
I don't know if you've ever gone back and listened to any of the sermons that you've given me input on that I've then preached, but I don't. You can probably see. Oh, he took my.
You probably make too many cat jokes.
Yeah. I always ax my cat jokes now, just from the jumps from jump.
You know what my answer is going to be when it comes to cats. Yeah.
Yeah. Make a something about dogs instead.
Right. I mean, God's people are dog people.
Well, that's one way to look at it.
Yeah.
One way to look at it, Agree to disagree. It's fine.
We are made in the
image honestly,
of God.
Though,
God is spelled G-O-D. You put that backwards in the reverse mm-hmm. image, and we're D-O-G. I mean, that's what we are.
And I'm going to be honest. I am fighting against myself here. There is, in Islam, they're big on cats. Muhammad was big on cats. They say the M pattern on a tabby cat's forehead is because Muhammad laid his hand on a cat and blessed it, and so now it has an M.
That would not surprise me.
Yeah, so
that's one
really
hadith that is
help.
Probably based in truth.
I will say, there was, and I know the man was the Antichrist, and I understand that, but there's a story about Muhammad that there was a cat sleeping on the sleeve of his cloak, and rather than disturb the cat, he cut the sleeve off the cloak and took it to let the cat sleep, which that's nice. I don't,
you say so.
I mean I can't do anything without disturbing one of my cats, but it's fine. So you just got off vicarage. How was that? How long was that?
So vicarage, yeah, that was 1 year of pastoral internship to the day. I began my internship on August 1st of 2020, and I ended it on July 31st of this year of 2021.
What was it like vicaraging through the COVID?
Oh boy, Lord have mercy.
I'm sorry, was it too big?
We're getting the big
too
question.
Too big a question.
Right, yeah. Well, as it is everywhere, COVID was difficult. How do we love our neighbors the best? How do we put our neighbors' interest and needs above our own, as we do everywhere in the Christian life? It was just seeing it in vicarage gave me an opportunity to see how a pastor handles crisis on a daily basis. Because there was always somebody getting sick, somebody being quarantined. We had a large ministry team at that congregation with two DCEs on staff and tech people and everybody else. And so if somebody was quarantined, that put a kink in our plans. Worship changes had to happen on the fly. So seeing a vicarage congregation function throughout COVID was a wonderful learning experience for me as a vicar. I did not ever envy my pastor as he was trying to navigate how best to love our neighbors when every single neighbor has a better idea on how to do it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so pray for our pastors during this time.
Yeah, it's definitely a challenge. I know we've had a rough time, you know, of it at our church. We pretty early on, I think, decided we missed that first Easter service. So we cut services, like, I think after the first week of Lent, we cut. We had one Lenten Vesper on a Wednesday, and then I think that was it. After that, we stopped. And we got past Easter, and our pastor said, "Yeah, that's not working for me. Not being in church on Easter is like not the thing." So we treaded pretty carefully. We broke into two services, socially distanced, masked. I have to give it up to the Baptists. In North Carolina, our governor said, I don't even care about religious services. You can't go to church. You know, we have to stop the spread or whatever. And a local Baptist church here in Fayetteville actually sued the governor and his office and won. And the Supreme Court of North Carolina ruled that you can't restrict people from religious gathering. And so
I wouldn't know the political circumstances in each local jurisdiction. But we also tried to obey our earthly rulers as far as mm-hmm. we could do so in good conscience.
Yeah.
And where we were on Vicarage, we were permitted to meet in person, provided we could provide ample spacing. So we mm-hmm. did. We had everybody wearing masks, but we realized, just as you did, we needed to be in person. We needed to be hearing our Lord's word and receiving his sacraments. And so within the first month of my vicarage, we had already gone back to live in-person worship. We had been providing a service of the word online, but it's not the same as being in person. And it's certainly not the same as being able to hold our Lord's precious body and blood in your hand and receive it into your own body. So within a month, we had gone back to somewhat normal services. We took precautions. Everyone was spaced out. When we had communion, we would bring it to the people rather than bringing them up to the rail where there would be possibility of cross-contamination or whatever. And of course, we used the individual cups and made sure that all of the hosts were individually ready for distribution.
Mm-hmm.
But we had returned to regular worship fairly quickly because we needed it. We needed to hear the good news and to receive the sacrament. And by the time I left, service was almost back to completely normal. The vaccinated people were without masks, as our local governments advised we could be. And we had everything except the donuts after church. You know.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we're just about back to normal. We split into two services to keep people spaced apart. We don't have the biggest congregation, so we split into two services just to give some room. Our sanctuary, I think, holds 140 people, according to the fire marshal. Mm-hmm. And I think before COVID, we'd get, on a really good Sunday, maybe 80, 85 people. Average Sunday, we were looking at about 50 to 60. So we split into two services. We've had a lot of people that just stay home. It took us a while to get live streaming up, but we're seeing a good response to that now. Yep. But I think the only thing at this point that we're...
Oh, sorry. Technology has been a blessing throughout this. And I imagine it will be going forward as well.
Yeah. I think the only thing we haven't gone back to right yet is we don't go up to the rail at this point. So people come up individually to receive the communion. So
that seems to be pretty common in most places right now.
Yeah. I would like to go back to the rail. But I also like keep pushing my pastor to get incense and do away with the tiny cups. So let's just everyone, there's one cup and we all get to share this cup. Yeah. So, but it's certainly an interesting time. So this is just going to be theological now.
Excellent. As this opposed is my favorite.
One would hope. I've been reading Martin Luther's Letters of Pastoral Comfort, and I don't know if you've read this little book, but it's really good.
Which publication is this one?
Hang on.
I'm guessing it's a CPH.
I actually don't know if it's CPH. It's on my Kindle here.
Oh, you're one of those.
I prefer the
books I can smell, Remy. The ones that if I have the incense burning, they'll smell like it for months and months.
Here's the thing about that. I only have the one little bookshelf, and it's full. So.
Well, I got nothing on you. There you go. That's fair reason.
So let me see. It just says Luther's Letters of Spiritual Counsel. I don't know. I don't know who wrote it or anything, because I don't know how to pull that up on my Kindle because I'm technologically illiterate. But it's very good. The whole first section of the book is letters to the sick and dying, commending the faith to them. So he pastored through a plague.
He did. He turned his house, the Black Cloister, into a hospital. In fact, that's when he wrote A Mighty Fortress. We think of it as this grand Reformation proud hymn, but it's a hymn of comfort in a time of death and suffering. Yeah. Sorry.
So
I interrupted. Go ahead.
No, it's great. It's great. So he writes these letters to people where they reach out to him through a connection or a letter, maybe themselves or a pastor of their congregation, whatever. They reach out to him and they say, Dr. Luther, I'm sick and I'm dying. And he writes them back every time without fail, thank God. Thank God you're sick and dying, because the suffering that you have here now chastises you so you won't have a greater suffering later. Or thank God that the Lord gave you a spouse even for a little while, even if it meant he had to take them back when you didn't want him to. Thank God that one day soon, because of your suffering, you will be with our Lord and there will be no suffering anymore. Have we forgotten how to be sick? Have we forgotten how to die?
Yes. 1,000 times, yes. And we Christians could do well to remember that our faith is about dying. Memento mori all the time. Remember that you will die. Remember death. And there's a couple different ways that we can remember this. There is a good sense in which we are to die every day to our sinful self. Remember that we are baptized children of God, and that because of that wonderful gift, we do not need to live as fearful, suffering people. In fact, we can rejoice in our sufferings, as Paul says, because suffering produces perseverance, and perseverance character, character hope, and that hope is not just some mere action or ethereal thing that we're hoping for. In that sense, the hope is a noun. It's a thing we possess because God has given it to us. And in that regard, we have nothing to fear from death. Death is a good thing in that we put to death that sinful old Adam within us and become the new man who Christ has made us in baptism. At the same time, death is evil. The fact that we have to kill that old Adam, which was created in the image of God, is a terribly sad thing. We Christians would do well to remember that it is because of our sin that there is death in this world.
Yeah.
Had it not been Adam, it would have been one of us to follow. It was only a matter of time before our sinful nature would take over and subvert God's will.
I've got, thanks to Concordia, they have these subscription plans where they rope you in and then just send you books, and then like you're excited because you got a book, and then they send you a bill and it's $800 because it's Concordia.
That sounds
very
about
upset.
Right.
Yeah,
we'll have to call our friend Peter Frank and complain.
I've got.
Peter, I love you if you're listening.
I doubt it. There's only like three people that will ever hear this. So, it's on the Last Judgment, and there's another one that goes along with that. But I think it's Johann Gerhardt. But it talks about life in three stages, salvation in three stages. There's first your physical birth. You have to be born. And then there is your rebirth in baptism. And then the final step of salvation is your death. So you have your birth, where your spirit and body are brought into being. And then you have your rebirth, where you are regenerated into the image of Christ. And then you have your death, where finally the old Adam is laid permanently to rest so that you can be resurrected in newness of life in Christ. And, oh, interesting. Interesting look at it.
I like it.
Yeah. It's sort of like the Eastern Orthodox view of like one day I will be saved, right? So like your American Baptist is sort of like I was saved when I was like 16 and I made a choice or whatever. And then you have, I guess the Catholic view is going to be I'm being saved with, you know, penance and Hail Mary or whatever. And then you have the Orthodox view that, like, one day I'm going to die, and I trust that Christ will save me in that day, you know.
Now what's the inscription over at Mount Athos? If you die before you die, you won't have to die when you die.
Yeah, solid.
The monks in the desert, they get it. They get this stuff.
They get it.
Yeah. Yeah.
They get it. So, yeah, we've definitely forgotten about the hope in death, for sure. I heard Brian Wolfmiller on Table Talk Radio, of all places. He dared to offer an opinion that was good, not even just sort of mediocre, but like pretty good.
Brian Wolfmiller is an outstanding pastor.
You've never heard Table Talk Radio.
I have never heard Table Talk Radio. Yeah. But I know Brian Wolfmiller, and at least his work, and it's trustworthy.
Yeah, no, he's amazing. He was talking about hope on Table Talk, and he said that for the pagan, hope is this sort of intangible, where it's rooted in fear, and it's things are going poorly, but I hope that they will go better. I hope it will work out. Whereas for the Christian, hope is a certainty. We aren't hoping against fear. We are hoping in the certainty of Christ. We know what our hope is. The pagan can only guess and pray that their hope is right.
Correct.
We know.
To the pagan, hope is a verb, and it's a verb that can change just as soon as something else changes and the situation itself changes. But to us Christians, hope is a noun which we possess. And that means that death is not something to fear anymore. Death is just another enemy to be conquered.
Yeah, another enemy
was conquered.
Yep, that's it.
That is the true good news, is that through his death, Jesus Christ has conquered death. And so we would answer that Baptist you mentioned before, you know, when were you saved? Well, about 2,000 years ago on a hill outside of Jerusalem.
Indeed.
And that's when I was saved.
I love it. Calvinist right now, head spinning.
Right.
In the pastoral letters of Luther, he mentions he's writing to a gentleman that just lost his wife, and he says, just by way to Christian hope, he says, just when you're too upset. When you're too upset, just remember your wife went to sleep in her bed against your bosom and woke up in bed against the Lord, right? Like she went to sleep cuddling you, her love, and woke up with Jesus, her true love, in paradise. And like, how great is that? that, you know, like you don't need to be sad. She's not.
Yeah. Isn't that something, you know, that particular example brings to mind a beautiful reading that's going to be coming up for those of us on the 3-year lectionary in 2 weeks from Ephesians 5. And just the image of Christ as the bridegroom to his bride, the church. Mm. I mean, you have the example of that man who you just mentioned there. He was not able to be a husband to his wife any longer because she had died. That specter of death had come between them because of the sin that is in this world. And so he was not able to be the husband anymore. And yet Christ is able to fulfill what we cannot because of our sinful condition. Christ will always be the husband to his church, to those who are part of that church, those called out ones. And it just is beautiful. And in 2 weeks, I hope every pastor is preaching on the epistle reading, because that's exactly what we're going to get from Ephesians 5, verses 21 is where the reading should start. And all the way through, I think, what, 33 or so?
I don't know. I'm on the superior 1 year.
Oh, so the 1 year. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm back on it now. I'm changing gears, but I've got a couple preaching engagements at the 3-year places, so I've got both running through my mind. But
that's great.
If you're on the 3-year, in 2 weeks, your pastor will be preaching, and hopefully on the Ephesians reading, where St. Paul tells us, submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. And then Paul does this amazing thing, and he uses marriage as an image for how to understand our relationship between God and his church. And Christ is this wonderful husband who lays down his life for his wife and the church, of course. And in return, we Christians, in response, are to live just like that, not just with our spouses, but with all people in the world. Can you imagine how quickly this pandemic would have been over had people lived entirely altruistically and selflessly instead of selfishly, if we would have had, say, politicians who on either side who didn't seek to make something a political issue for personal gain, but instead truly sought to do the best for their neighbor, regardless of whether it would score them points in the press. And press who did the same thing and sought to report things honestly and openly, instead of seeking to profit and get a name on a byline and a little more recognition.
Yeah. And this that's the problem, though. That's the problem, is if the politicians don't do the bad thing and the press doesn't do the bad thing, they don't make the money. And, you know, you're okay, Don. You're okay. But here's the thing. No one, your local, your congressman, your city representative, your mayor, your governor, they don't know your name. And they don't care. They don't care. If someone told your state senator or your federal congressman, hey, there's a guy named Don and he's upset that you don't know his name, they'd be like, okay, whatever. Anyway, I got this check coming from this guy to say this thing, so that's what I care about, right?
Yeah, and yet we can juxtapose that to a guy who does know us all by name, who called us by name, and he's a good shepherd, and he doesn't care about the paycheck because it's already paid. And that's the one who we should be putting our trust in during this crazy time. And Luther's pastoral letters, he leads his people into that same space. He wants them to understand, give thanks. Your loved one is dead. Give thanks to God.
Mm-hmm.
What a mind-boggling way to look at things, right? So we look at ourselves during this pandemic, and we should be introspective. We should be considering our sin. I mean, divine chastisement is real. Mm-hmm. This is chastening. Now, I'm not going to pin it on any particular sin. That would be overstepping Scripture. But it is certainly true that God sends us what we deserve and sometimes what we seek out. And since we do not seek out the best for our neighbor, we reap the rewards of that.
Unfortunate benefits.
Yeah. Yeah. What do we call those? D-benefits? Yeah. So we should all be praying and fasting and praying for God to take this pandemic from us.
Yeah.
And then doing all we can for our neighbors to ensure that it doesn't continue.
You know what I found interesting? By the way, the book, I'm going to leave a link in the description to the book. It is Luther, Letters of Spiritual Counsel by Theodore Tappert. And I'll leave a link to it.
He's the same guy who translated one of the translations of the Book of Concord, and it's a favorite of many. I won't say
He did. He did in these, he says right at the outset, and the book was originally written, I don't even know when, 2018 is what Amazon says, but I don't know if that's right. But he says that all of these letters he gathered and translated himself, and that the majority of them are first time anyone's ever translated them. So,
yep. And if anybody wants to continue in his footsteps, there are many, many German, old High German documents here at Concordia Seminary that they could help themselves to in the rare books office, and somebody would be very glad to have them translated.
Feel free to come on by.
Yeah,
you donate your time. But yeah, I'll leave a link to that in the description. So getting back to vicarage, because that was kind of my idea here. Was it too short or too long?
Vicarage was a dream, and it went by just about as quickly. And I could have spent the rest of my life learning under the tutelage of my wonderful supervisor. But I think a year is probably about the right amount of time that I have a taste and a hunger for ministry, and I want to return to it, which makes this fourth year very hard. In the LCMS, we have this practice of 2 years of seminary training where you learn your Greek and your Hebrew and your systematics, and you get a solid foundation in your dogmatics and your homiletics that you can preach and not be terrible. And then you get sent out onto vicarage during your third year of your MDiv study, and then you return to the seminary for one fourth and final year. Makes that fourth year so hard, because I've been in the parish now. I've learned how to apply all this good material that I've had by wonderful professors, and I've been able to do what Luther does a little bit and comfort people, bring the gospel to others. I had the great privilege of doing a commendation for the dying when my pastor was stuck in quarantine for 34 days. I was called up from the minors to go and minister to this dying man, and it was beautiful. Someone who is incapable of speech in general, but when the Lord's Prayer was recited, suddenly his eyes were open and he looked intensely at me. And just those ways in which the gospel brings the good news to those who even we think are unreachable, it was marvelous. And so vicarage was probably just the right amount of time. I'm hungry to go back and share more gospel.
Okay. That's a solid answer. But do you feel that it was, I guess it's like fatherhood.
I was just thinking in my mind, nobody's ready to have kids, but I got three of them, and
That's exactly what I was going for. Cause like you can save money, you can get out of debt and do all these other things before you have kids, which is good. And it's good to do. No one's going to shame you for wanting to be debt free before you have kids. I think that's a wise decision if you can make it happen in a reasonable amount of time. But also I know that no amount of preparation is ever going to get you there, right? Like you just, some things you just got to dive in, huh?
Yeah. And the seminary is certainly one of them.
Yeah.
I have a habit of discouraging anyone who is considering pastoral ministry at first, just to kind of test them. I think that's one of the first roadblocks, because I don't think a lot of men realize what exactly it is that they're getting themselves into and how much of their lives they will be devoting to others, especially in our country where we are very comfortable with our individual rights and our level of accommodations and a certain way of living. And in the ministry, you lose that. You gain something far greater, but you lose that. You are no longer your own. In fact, that beautiful verse in Romans about being bought at a price comes even more alive. And you see your Savior's work at work in others' lives too, that much more clearly. But once they get past my first hurdle of discouragement, if they make it into seminary, they'll get all of my encouragement and help and assistance, as somebody here on this podcast knows.
Yes. Thank you. For those who, if I haven't said this already on the recording, every good sermon I've ever written was written by Don.
It was not written by me, Remy. You did it.
Speaking of Stein's trials for the seminarian, do you feel the person I discourage the most from doing this is myself? I want to do this, but I very much do not want to do this. Is that normal?
Yeah, we're cutting back to our earlier conversation. I think that's normal. I mean, our conversation earlier about how we have to put that old Adam to death every day. Yeah. It comes even that much more alive when you're a pastor. The devil works hardest on those who are drawing closer to Christ. And if he can knock down somebody who is in the office of public ministry, who is supposed to be above reproach, and just make them that much more reproachable, he's going to do it. So, there are always those discouraging thoughts that will come by. It's no coincidence that pastors suffer from depression on a much higher average than the average human being. In some ways, ministry is a great burden, even though it is filled with great joys.
Yeah. Do you ever feel like you're not doing enough?
Always.
I mean, like you see a homeless guy and you know you got $5 in your pocket. You know, like you should give the guy.
I got $5 in my pocket. I'm a seminarian, Remy. Oh, yeah, I got about 2.
Okay, so then, well, this is awkwardly autobiographical. And then you, definitely not me. I would do it, but you don't give him the $5. And then it's, you know, why? Like, I don't know. I often feel like I'm not doing enough.
I don't think you will ever feel like you are doing enough. I don't think it's possible for a human being to ever do enough. How's that for the answer?
Yeah, no, that is the answer.
Yeah, and we never will. And that's also the blessing in it too, is that it doesn't matter what we do. The gospel comes from Christ, who has done everything that needs to be done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting, if I could also circle back. Luther recommends praying for the sick, the demon possessed, and various others. His recommended rite for exorcism is super fascinating because it's basically nothing. It's just like
pray.
Yeah. Get a few good men from your church to go, and we'll all say the Lord's Prayer and the Creed together. Baptize the person if they're not, and then, you know, that's that. Move on with your day. But he mentions as far as like praying for the sick and the dying, praying for yourself in matters of faith and conscience, addiction, things of the sort. He says you should ask God to do the thing for you 3 consecutive days.
Huh.
And, you know, so like day one, mention it in your prayers. Hey, God, can you remove this thorn from my side? Day two, God, can you remove this thorn from my side? Day three, God, can you remove this thorn from my side? And if it's still not gone by day four, you just assume the answer is no and move on with your life in the knowledge and the peace that God's grace is sufficient. And he specifically says you shouldn't keep pestering God about a thing, because it's not like he didn't hear you. You know, he heard you the first time.
That's possibly some good advice. God hears our prayers. I'm not sure if I'd tie it down to a specific number like he did there, but
right.
Yeah.
Well, and to go sort, I guess to go against that, because I mean, there is the, I grew up Pentecostal, and there is the urge to continually wail and cry out. But that's sort of borne out by like Moses, right?
Right. How many times does he plead on behalf of Israel?
Yeah. And it works.
Yeah. I'm not sure I have an answer for there. If there's a question there.
I'm not really sure there was a question. It was just kind of a statement.
It's an interesting think about.
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely something to think about. I think it probably sort of goes back to this theology of faith. Faith, I guess, is what I'm trying to reach for. But this, we're just going to trust God in however He's going to work this out, and you know, providence, and we're going to hands off. You know,
yep,
not my department. You know,
not my monkeys, not my circus.
That's what they say. Not my chair, not my problem.
Yep.
Yep. So, what was the most enlightening part of Vicarage? What was like the most changed mindset for you? The most shattered misconception about ministry?
So I would spend hours tweaking a sermon, making sure it was just so, making sure that every jot and tittle was exactly where it ought to be. And I found out you don't have time for that when you're busy washing feet.
Yeah.
Washing feet metaphor, the euphemism for actually doing the work of ministry, the pastoral care, going to the nursing homes and visiting the shut-ins, taking that call at 3 a.m. to somebody who needs you, going to the hospital when there's been that emergency, comforting the bereaved family when the teenage son has died in a horrible accident. These are all the real works of ministry, and not to take anything away from the pastoral office of preaching. That is very important, but you don't have as much time to prepare as you do when you're sitting in the ivory tower of a seminary. And so I learned real quickly, my biggest eye-opening thing of Vicarage was that I don't have 20 hours to prepare a sermon. I have nowhere near that. And there was the saying in homiletics classes that for every minute of sermon writing, you need to expend about an hour's worth of research and work. And to some extent, that is true if you include the time that you spend in introspection and the study of the scriptures as well, and not just in the fine textual work and writing of the sermon.
Right.
And here's what I mean by that. I would read the scriptures on a Monday morning, and I would check with the Greek and the Hebrew, depending on what the text was that I felt was calling to me. I would read through all three, I would contemplate where the church was at. I'd go with a couple of those, and if there was a theme, I would toss around ideas of the theme in my head. And then later that day, I would go to visit shut-ins, and I would kind of test out a little bit of the gospel there. See if that little sermon might preach, if there was a little something there. And it wasn't that I was going up to these people and saying, hey, can I read you this text from scripture? And here is what I'm thinking. That's not what I mean. I mean, I would compose what we'd call a rhetorical unit in my mind, a section of a sermon that I think holds together well, that I think would get the general idea that I would like to get across. And I would test it out, see how it worked. And if they would be really engaged and interested in my story, well, hey, this could work as I help to explain this text and bring it to life for the people. And I'd toss it around a little more for a couple hours as I'm driving in the car to the next place or whatever. And little by little, I'd have this sermon written in my head before I ever put it down to paper so that, you know, when Thursday or Friday came around, when I sat down to write the sermon, it was written in my head and I just needed to put it to paper. And that, in that way, I learned a text more than I prepared to preach a text. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the most eye-opening part of parish ministry, was realizing how quickly sermon writing can actually come together when you are doing the work of a pastor and caring for people.
Yeah. 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 A lot of that hour to minute bit too, I think you mentioned like the more granular aspects of getting down into the Greek or the Hebrew and all that. And I mean, the truth is you really, I mean, how many times in your life are you going to translate John 6:36 by yourself? You know what I mean? You're going to do it maybe a couple of times, but eventually, like, you get the gist.
And even if I can do it, I'm going to be double-checking it with my concordances and making sure that I'm not, you know, accidentally translating some terrible heresy.
Right, with a guy you know for a fact can do it, you know. But it compounds, right? A lot of that sort of work, you do it enough early on, and later you can reap the benefits. Okay, I understand the Greek of this passage because I've translated this enough times that,
right,
like, I know it now, you know. Yep. So, I'm not the only person then that writes these things on a Friday night.
No, you're not.
Okay, great.
But it's been written for like the week. It's not all new on Friday.
No. It's definitely Monday. I'm going to read it. And I just read it and I spend Monday trying to find a cohesive theme between everything.
You try to use all three readings.
Yeah.
More power to you. I usually focus on one text unless there's something that is clearly right there.
Yeah, I mean, I focus on one text for the bulk of a sermon, but it just seems to me that we're not going to put three completely different readings together for no reason.
There were some smart people who put those lectionaries together once
upon a time. Right. So there's a thread running through them, and I want to find that if I can. And then I'll do readings in different translations. I'll pull up commentaries. I'll see how different people handle it. I don't have the luxury of the Greek or Hebrew, but my pastor is very much with the Greek.
Isn't he a amazing Hebrew guy?
Huh?
I thought he's a Hebrew guy.
He's a Greek guy. Okay. He will literally, I sat with him one day and I was beating my head against the wall over this text and I was like, I don't understand. And he said, meet me at Buffalo Wild Wings. We'll grab some wings and some beer and we'll figure this thing out. And so we go, we meet up, and he says, all right, what's the text? And I gave him the reference, and he pulled it up and then literally just read it in Greek. Just read it in Greek and then translated it on the spot. And then I was blown away.
Yeah, I know that. Where he went to seminary. They don't mess around, and they start young. They get a leg up. They get a leg up on us LCMSers, especially us who are coming into its second career. I had to take a 7-week crash course in Greek so that I could get into seminary.
Oh,
I had
to do
the same for Hebrew so that I can continue on to my second year. And I'm still like struggling and learning week to week. Yeah, I am envious of the guys who earned it and learned it at such a younger age.
Yeah, Hebrew scares the crap out of me. Greek, I'm not worried about Greek. I feel like Greek is tangible, but Hebrew is so foreign.
So Greek is the thinking man's language. It all just makes good sense.
Oh, so I'm
exactly
doomed.
What it's supposed to be. And Hebrew has like real simple 3-letter root. It should all be easy, right? Except for, you know, all the times that it doesn't. It's like I before E except after C. Except that never works.
Right. That's the exception.
Rule. Yeah.
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 Golly. Yeah, I'm the most worried about Hebrew, but I'll end up falling in love with it and hating Greek, I'm sure, just because that's going to confound all of my current expectations. So, what is the one part of being a pastor that corollary to the last question, you were dead on. You thought, oh yeah, that's exactly how I thought it would be.
The management of things that aren't directly related to the pastoral office. I mean, like the worldly things, setting a budget, budgeting time, managing individuals in an office, in a team ministry setting. All those things are exactly as I imagine them to be. That's where your gifts from the outside world are of great value. So if you were a manager in a past life, you are going to have a great time doing that kind of stuff.
What were you in your past life?
I was a staffer for the United States Congress.
Oh, yeah, no, that makes sense. That totally connects, yeah.
And then I had three interns working for me back then. That was nice because I earlier, could do my dirty work.
Earlier when I said your senator didn't know your name, I just want to retract that. I was wrong. He obviously did.
The senator probably didn't, but my representative certainly did. I had to oversee 176 congressional districts for my third of the country at the national office that I was at. So I had a lot of work. It was a fun place for a single guy fresh out of college to be. Not an easy place for a Christian to work, and certainly not a good place to start a family. And that's why we moved back to the Midwest when we got married. My wife had been living in Virginia and I was in DC proper. And we decided, you know, it's not worth it to be in a city where I have to take public transit for about 3 hours just to see you, even though we're only a couple of miles apart. Let's just move to the Midwest and and start a family. So yeah. We did.
My brother-in-law and my sister were in DC for the longest time. He's such a great guy because he has all these amazing titles that he just never uses. And my sister and I, we were actually talking about this. He's a licensed attorney on I think every state on the Eastern Seaboard. He's passed like every bar on the East Coast. He has been educated at some of the best universities in the U.S. and some of the best universities in the U.K. Wow. He has so many degrees in the law and in religion and in all these different things. He's amazing. And he had some really highfalutin D.C. job. And he made hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. And they could afford a two-bedroom, one-bathroom apartment. And it was like poverty-level living. So on like $250,000 a year.
My poor wife, she was living in a what are those called? It's not a single unit. What are those called?
Studio.
A studio, right? So it's one room with like a kitchenette on the side and a bathroom that you can like partition closed. Otherwise, like that's your room. So that's where she lived. And on my salary, all I could afford was living with five other people in one house up in, well, it was Northwest, so it was pretty nice. But I had one room of this house that we split between five people in order to afford. So I don't miss living out there, not one bit.
So your wife does love you a lot.
She really does. She truly does. She demonstrated that. Yeah.
So much much better, you think the ministry a lot more cohesive, a lot better emotionally, spiritually, overall. It's not as fast paced or as the world would look at it as important, quote unquote, you know, as being a mover and a shaker in DC, but better. And
you know, it's interesting. I'm not sure that I would say it's any slower of a pace than when I was on the Hill. In fact, in some ways, the pace is quicker because there are expectations that have to be met. You have to have that sermon ready. You have to have the liturgy worked out. You have to know what's coming down the line. You have to be looking ahead to Lent and Advent and having those extra services prepared ahead of time. Otherwise, you're going to be drowning. And then at the same time, you've got Murphy's Law hanging over you in a way that it didn't on the hill. Mm. On the hill, you could always slough something off. You know, leave a job you didn't want to an intern, or if something was above your pay grade, then that was your answer. There are no clear lines with pastoral ministry, and sometimes the ball drops to you, and you got to do something with it. Mm. Yeah. So I suppose the 80 hours a week that I used to do out in D.C. are probably about the same time-wise, but they are much more fulfilling because I know that I'm actually making a difference in people's lives, that I am sharing the good news of Jesus Christ with them.
Yeah. Are you a, and I feel I know the answer to this question, at least on Vicarage, were you a collar everywhere guy?
We wore business casual in the office, unless there was service. If there was service, or if I was going to a nursing home, or if I was making visits, I wore my collar as a representation of the office which I was representing. Mm-hmm. I myself was not the pastor, but I was representing the pastor to God's people. Therefore, I should reflect that office. And so, yeah, I wore a collar in public functions, all public functions. But in the office itself, nah, I'd wear the polo.
Okay.
Maybe my bow ties.
Good. I have a few.
Good man. Good man.
Obviously not clip-on.
No.
Good. Excellent.
We're much too refined for that nonsense.
Yeah.
It's like Provolone cheese.
It took me an embarrassing amount of time to figure out how to tie a bow tie. And I say embarrassing because it seems really complex. But then you say, oh, it's just tying my shoe on my neck.
Remy, don't tell the secret. We are in this society. We don't need to let more people in here.
Sorry. No, it's like that. It's like what the thing I said, but more complicated and with extra steps.
There you go.
You have to fight a Balrog every morning. It's you know, something. But did you ever get mistaken for a Roman Catholic? And how fun was that conversation?
I mean, that happens in St. Louis. That happened my first year of seminary. You know, somebody would come up to you, Father, I need to pray right now.
Excellent.
Okay, I'm happy to pray with you. I am, however, a Lutheran seminarian. Is that all right? I don't know what that is, but can you pray with me? Let's pray.
Yes. Yep. Great. I would trick people into the kingdom and not even tell them that. But I would just.
No, we cannot be duplicitous. You know, it's funny. The collar.
I mean, I would tell them like later.
Of course. Yeah, you know, it's funny because the collar itself began as an Anglican use. Us Lutherans, we typically preached either in the academic robes of our institutions, or we might wear, what are those called? The tabs, the preaching tabs, the white ones mm-hmm. that you see in the old-timey videos. And that was common even through the 1900s. Generally, people wore the Geneva gown. If they wore white at all, it would be a simple surplice that would go over. I still have a couple old black cassocks that I've inherited from pastors as they've passed on. And I like to wear cassock and surplice for non-communion Sundays, and then I'll wear my big white alb that's the plain white robe for communion Sundays as a reminder that we've been washed clean totally from head to toe in the blood of the Lamb, which we are feasting on. Everything we do is to teach, and the same with wearing that collar day in and day out whenever it was a public function, because we were teaching as we were going about. And people recognize that. I mean, I can't count the number of times I've gotten into a hospital because I had the collar on. They won't give you the number of somebody's hospital office if you're just dressed in like me.
Right
now, wearing, you know, just a polo shirt and shorts. But if you are dressed the part, they recognize that you are there to serve, and they'll help you. So, yeah, the collar opens doors.
Yeah, that's wild. Did you know that the CIA, fun fact, won't let their, if they're inserting an agent into a foreign country undercover, they will not allow their cover to be clergy or healthcare, because they don't want actual clergy and actual healthcare to come under attack because of that. Interesting.
Good. They'd be exposed pretty quick too.
It's pretty wild. It's pretty wild that you say that, like, you get that, like, that kind of access. I work in government myself and have attempted to use the weight of that to complete an investigation and do that. And I get rebuffed. You know, people say, oh, I don't care. You know, if it's that big a deal, you can contact so-and-so, an attorney, and it's like, holy crap, you know.
Yeah, I've never thrown around the weight of the office in that way, but when it comes to helping somebody, I think it can be pretty effective. Because people...
Not to imply that you have or would, but just that I have to, in my day job, throw around what my day job is, and I get nowhere, and... You walk into a hospital with a collar, and it's like, "Oh, great, come this way."
Yeah,
you don't even have to, you know.
You know, one of the downsides of that, of course, is that people do recognize the office, and so if I'm going to make a hospital visit, I just factor in an extra 30 minutes because it's almost every time that somebody else has need of you or just wants to talk, or a nurse needs your ear for a second or five that turn into, you know, 30 minutes. It's the joy of the office that comes with it.
Yeah. So those kinds of things specifically make me want to, when I get there, wear a collar everywhere to sleep in the thing if I could. Because when else are you going to get such, like, great random encounters where people just walk up to you, you know, and maybe they're completely irreligious and they've been raised atheist all their life, but they saw a TV show and they know that that means priest or whatever. And so they walk up to you at a gas station and they're just like, "Hey, can you talk? You know, my kid got into a car accident."
I've had those kind of interactions before too and been called some rather unkind names. And it happens. It comes with the territory. And that's again, the joy of ministry. You get to minister to that person too.
Say, how do you not be... How do you not be angry?
You smile. How can you be angry? How can you possibly be angry? Christ has already conquered everything. Dr. Jeff Gibbs, Pastor Jeff Gibbs, wrote a great article called The Myth of Righteous Anger. And that would be a great read and a great talk about someday on some podcast somewhere. And it's all about how we human beings... We get this idea that we have every right to be angry, and I'm not so sure we do anymore.
We were always taught growing up I went to a school affiliated with my church, and we were always taught growing up that there is such a thing as, like, a perfect righteous anger. And you can see that in Christ when he's, like, flipping the tables at the temple and driving people out with a whip and all this. It's this appropriate, restrained, perfect anger. It's not emotionally overheated. It's done in a sinless way and all this. And we were taught that that is a thing, and that is a real thing that Jesus did, and you're not Jesus, and you're never gonna be able to be angry and also be sinless about it.
Right, right. When Christ went through the temple and overturned all those tables belonging to the tax collectors and everything else, that was Jesus.
Yeah.
And if you are God, then you can, you know, pour out God's bowl of wrath. But until that day, better abstain from attempts to do it.
Yeah. You know, I find it interesting. Just one thing I've noticed, and this is not any kind of a study or anything, but just something I've noticed is that In the office of the keys and in all these places where we're given these things, we're told you have the power to forgive sin and the power to retain sin against people. You're given the ability to do both, right? Mm. To forgive someone or to unforgive them, to keep forgiveness from them, right?
Well, that's an interesting question.
But you're never given the command to do anything other than forgive.
There we go.
Right. So you're given You're given, here are the keys. You can unlock the door or you can lock the door, but you're only allowed to unlock the door.
Right. The pastor exists solely to forgive sins. And this is one of the greatest comforting things that I hope people can learn. And I think more pastors need to teach on this. And I was blessed to be at a vicarage where this was instilled in me. The pastor exists to proclaim the gospel, period. Yes, proclaiming of the law happens alongside that. It must. I mean, we can't rightly distinguish law from gospel if we're lacking one or the other. But it is the gospel for which we have been called to share. That's what we do. We unlock. We aren't there to bind up people's hearts and make them suffer and bind consciences to worldly things. We are there to set them free in Christ. Mm-hmm. That is it. So when somebody comes to confess a sin, the pastor does not judge. The pastor does not wonder if they're really sorry. The pastor forgives. That is it.
Yep.
Yeah. And yep. That has been freeing for me to know that I can always go to my pastor and confess sins and be forgiven and receive forgiveness.
And I would like to just take a moment and wholeheartedly say that this goes not just for your pastor, for the people out there listening, but this is an office given to, while it is specifically given to pastors, given in general to the church as a gift to the church, this forgiveness. If you have friends that you trust that you can go to, you know, maybe you're new at a church and you're weird about private confession or whatever, I would encourage you to get over that. But if you have a friend or if your children come to you, dads, and they say, hey, I did this thing, you know, feel free to forgive them. That's one of the greatest gifts of Christianity, right? Is that forgiveness. Feel free to share it around.
I can't believe I didn't talk about this earlier. So one of these amazing things that happened at my vicarage congregation, I was there about 2 days, and I had accidentally bumped into somebody as I was walking through a doorway, just, oh, sorry. And I did my Wisconsin thing. I even did the, oh, sorry. And I walked by, and I didn't think anything of it. And the man stood up, and he turned and looked at me, and he said, you are forgiven. And then he turned and walked away. And here I am, the new vicar, thinking, oh, no, what have I done? And I knew this man was an elder. And I was thinking, oh, boy, I've offended an elder. I've only been here a couple of days. I'm doomed. I'm going to fail vicarage. I'm never going to be a pastor. And it turns out that this church had spent an entire year, a couple of years ago, on the topic of forgiveness and how important it was that Christians needed to hear that those beautiful words, you are forgiven. And so he had turned to make sure that I knew I was forgiven.
Yeah.
And so for the rest of that year, after I had been informed of this by him kindly a couple of days later, I had asked him, wondering if I had accidentally offended him. He explained to me what was actually going on. And after I knew that whole year at that congregation was just so liberating, because you'd overhear it in the hallways. And suddenly I could hear the forgiveness that was going around in this place. You are forgiven. You are forgiven. Oh, it's okay. You are forgiven. It was real. People took that to heart and started living it. Yeah. And if we could do that. Yeah. Ooh.
We have a guy that's he's in Louisiana. And he's trying to join the AALC right now. He's going through it. He just has an independent congregation. And his church is called Absolution Church.
And excellent.
Right there, you know, you have the altar and you have the cross. And then it's going to be a little unorthodox, perhaps. But right next to the cross, just not quite centered over the altar, but right next to the cross, in giant letters, it says, you are forgiven. And he's had people come in, walk into his church, visitors, and they turn and they see the altar and the cross and the words, and that's it. You just break down, right? And it's just No one has ever actually said that to me.
I mean, that's what we Christians should see in our minds every time that we see a crucifix. And Luther writes something to that effect. Which letter was it in?
If you don't get this right, you're going to fail.
Is it to Johann?
All of your seminary coming to bear.
I can't remember which one, Remy. This is terrible. I read it just a couple days ago, but Luther talks about it, and he says, you know, look on the corpus. Look at your Christ and see his hands outstretched for you. You know, we aren't Jansenists. Our cross doesn't have Jesus with hands up just for some because he doesn't want to touch them all. His hands are outstretched for the entire human world, taking everybody in that one big hug of forgiveness. Oh, now we're huggy and touchy. All right, but you get
the
idea.
That's okay. It's good. It's like a good hug.
I'm going to have to find that Luther quote.
Yeah. Yeah, because I got to put it in the show notes, so. Gotta be. So you mentioned earlier that when you bumped into this elder, you were worried that you would fail vicarage. Can you fail vicarage?
Fail vicarage. It happens every year. There's at least one.
How? How do you fail vicarage?
By being insubordinate, by accidentally spewing some heresy. I don't know. I don't want to know. There are many factors that go into whether a man is suitable for the office of public ministry. He must manage his own family well. I mean, we can go right through Paul's admonitions to Timothy. And at some point, every man or another is going to fall short of at least one of those. No one is perfect, but in general, those must be upheld. At some point, due to circumstances either beyond that seminarian's control or by their own doing, some men disqualify themselves, at least for a time. And so they'll resume their studies and try again in a couple of years. Or sometimes they realize, you know, pastoral ministry isn't for me, and I think I'm going to go into theological study and serve the church in another way as a layperson. And those are good. I mean, seminary is not just a time for training to become a pastor. It is a time for formation of a pastor. And some men are not formed to be pastors. The Holy Spirit has different plans for each of us.
I know we mentioned the trials of Don earlier and how you discourage everyone who comes to you and says, hey, I'm thinking about this. But would you just in general, would you encourage men to at least investigate seminary in the ministry?
Oh, you got me nailed now. All right. Yes, I think there are many men who are well suited to ministry, both in their personality and in their capabilities intellectually, who would make fine pastors. And I think there are many men who have a pastoral heart who can overcome the issues that they may have intellectually and become fine pastors. And I do encourage those men to look more into pastoral ministry, especially if the one thing holding them back is financial security. The apostles never had financial security. Jesus Christ himself never worried about financial security. The Holy Spirit will provide if this is what you are meant to be doing. There's another interesting thing that happens during seminary. There always seems to be enough. You're never well off by any means, but there's always enough. There's a food bank at seminary so that your family never has to go hungry. I mean, if you aren't picky about what you eat, you never really have to buy groceries. There are financial assistances available so that seminary is affordable in the regular cost of living. And tuition is not free, but it is guaranteed in that there are supporters who will adopt a seminarian to make sure that he gets the education he needs to serve God's people. So yes, you caught me. If you are a man who is considering entering the ministry, but you're concerned about your financial well-being, or you're thinking that you might not be quite smart enough for it, or you're fearful of some other silly reason, take the plunge.
And if you're worried about all the papers you have to write, trust me, they don't actually get thoroughly read. Professors skim. They skim.
I don't know about that. I've had some pretty in-depth...
Anyone can put together a paper. Just write something. So, you know, it's funny because... So your advice for people that are worried about the financial aspect of it is the apostles were poor, Jesus was poor, get over it.
Yeah.
I mean, not, you know, maybe not word for word.
Yeah. I mean, coming to seminary is in its own way a certain vow of poverty. That's mm-hmm. always been there. I mean, you can't take any of this stuff with you anyways. What are you accumulating it for? It's better to share it with others anyway.
Yeah. It's I'm reminded a friend of mine went on a missions trip to Africa and ended up meeting his wife and crazy story. Ended up living there for like 6 years or something. But one day he was sharing the story with me. He was over there and they had a bunch of youth, young kids, not even youth, like children. And his wife was out with some of the other people. They were out there with these kids doing whatever. And it came about time for food. And so, my friend went inside and started making peanut butter and jelly sandwiches because they had a jar of each and a loaf of bread. And he was like, all right, well, let's go. And so he starts making PB&Js. And he said that he was just singing a hymn, praying a prayer, making PB&Js. Just, you know, not really doing anything.
Things we do,
put it on a paper plate, pass it along to whoever's coming in. They would come in, grab a couple of plates, and go back out. And at one point, his wife walked in, and he was making a sandwich, and he set it on the plate, and he looked over at the bread, and it was about half the bag of half the loaf of bread was gone. And he said, hey, we're about half this loaf out. How many more kids do we need to feed? Because somebody's going to probably have to go get another loaf of bread. And she said, well, no, we fed all the kids. And he said, well, that can't be right, because there are dozens of kids out there and I only have the loaf of bread here.
Look at him doing a miracle already.
Like literally, right? So I don't know. Like God provides, you know, God provides. And it's, I don't know. I'm sure you can as well see in your own life the times where like this was clearly an act of providence.
Yeah. I mean, there was the time that the car needed major work and we were wondering how we were going to pay for it. And suddenly came this check from my home congregation out of the blue. There was the time when, we lost a member of our family and out of the blue came meals that people didn't even know that we had suffered a loss and they were just happened to bring one by. The number of times something like that has happened is just beyond count.
Yeah. And it's, you know, you can see it. You can look back and you can clearly see. You can't see it at the time, right? Like maybe sometimes you can, but it's not, it's more one of those things where like you look back on your life and you go, you know, holy cow, that was providence was the word we used to use for it that we don't use anymore, but divine providence, you know, it was,
the Lord knows the needs of his saints and he provides what they need.
Yeah. And readily and abundantly. And it doesn't always feel like abundance because our American idea of abundance, I think, is probably wrong, but it's always what you need when you need it for however long, you know.
Yeah.
It's there. I've said that before, from the pulpit, that we often make the mistake of assuming our daily bread comes from our job, but it doesn't. Our daily bread comes from the Lord, maybe through our job right now, but it's ultimately from
provides,
God.
He provides the job anyways. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
All that we have is thine above, right? What is it we sing in the offertory? A trust from thee, our King. Well, did you have any more questions about my vicarage?
What's next for you? Writing a book?
We'll see. I got a couple of brothers in my winkle who are working on some kind of devotional.
In your what?
My winkle. All right. That's a fun word. So at seminary, you get assigned to a winkle. That's the German word for corner. And when you're in a corner, it means you've always got somebody there with you. On your side, in your corner, okay, if you will. And so a winkle is a place where we can kind of come together and share our concerns and joys and prayers and kind of accountability partners in the ministry, if you will.
That's awesome.
Yeah, they're great. And in the LCMS in general, we have winkles, real ones, not just seminary ones, but real ones where you get together with the local area pastors. And you don't get to pick who's in your winkle. Well, neither you don't get to do that at seminary either. And in fact, they assign us based on personality types in part to be with people who are very different from ourselves. So we have no choice but to get out of our comfort zone and meet different kinds of people. And, you know, going through 4 years together, they become your closest brothers. And yeah, it's a joy. Yeah. Have I said that word enough yet? Everything's a joy.
Can it be said enough? Is the question, and the answer is no.
I'm not sure it can.
Yeah, no, not at all. Not at all. Well, thank you so much for doing this with me. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was. Remy, it's good to see your face. Thanks.
You too. You too. I would like to extend to you, as I do to everyone, an open invite. Anytime you want to do this again, let me know.
Sure. You name the topic, and I'll be right here next time we talk about the Green Bay Packers.
That's great. The worst team in baseball. I don't know anything about sports, so probably not.
You are forgiven.
But I can... Oh, yes! Solid. Well, you enjoy your night. There's my cat. The people playing at home. Oh, look, there's two of them.
Oh.
This one only has one eye.
That's the cool very one. Sad.
Yeah, yeah, she's
cool. Yeah, because he's less cat by missing that eye.
Yeah, walks on a leash like a dog.
Okay, that's actually pretty cool.
It's great.
Although you also are forgiven for having cats.
Well,
I'm just going to end with that word. You are forgiven.
Excellent. Great seeing you, Don. Thank you so much.
Yep, take care.
Bye.